There are so-called surface codes. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is show you a few pictures, give you the definition, and then consider representative cases. And from then on, we will show you a few properties of these things. Let's start with the graph states. So, what I've shown here is a graph G, which consists of a set of vertices, 1, 2, 3 in this example, and of edges. And we associate with that graph the quantum system in the following way. Well, at each vertex, we place a qubit. And with the edges, we associate interaction that has happened in the past to create the state. About that, I will talk later. For the moment, we have qubits sitting on the vertices, and they have been entangled in a particular way, and I'm going to give you the definition right now, definition of a graph state. So, vertices and edges is given. I think I'm probably blocking the view here, so what I'm going to do about this.
Just write it and then
okay.
We'll see.
And the corresponding graph state G is given by a set of eigenvalue equations. I'm going to step back in a minute. Okay. It's a definition of a graph state. So let me just go through what I have written here. We have defined the graph state as a joint eigenstate of a set of Pauli operators. Well, that's what you usually do in the stabilizer formalism. So, well, I'll show you. Well, maybe I should do this first. So, what does the stabilizer look like? So, we pick an arbitrary vertex A. Yes?
What does that substrate say? There's not open back
here. You want to read me this part? So, it is B with the edge A comma B is in the edge set. Yeah. Okay, give me an illustration. So let's choose this as vertex A. So then we have a Pauli operator for this operator here, stabilized operator, a Pauli operator sigma X sitting here, and Pauli operator sigma Z sitting on all of its neighbors. So that's it. And we have such an operator associated with every vertex. So, we have as many stabilizer generators as we have qubits. So that's a particular case. Namely, sort of the Hilbert space, the code space that is stabilized by all these operators one-dimensional. So in this particular case, we end up with a single state. That's the definition of the graph state. Okay, dry definition. Let me give you an example. Let's consider the graph of a two-dimensional lattice. Okay, as before, qubits sitting on the vertices. This is called a cluster state. A graph state with this particular underlying graph is called a cluster state. thinking that it could come in various sizes, of course, depending on the size of the lattice. And it has a funny property that has to do with computation. Namely, what you have heard about today is how to do quantum computation with unitary gates, right? Sequences of gate implemented, say, by NMR pulses and so on and so forth. And I mean, yeah, the circuit model of quantum computation is like that. You concatenate a long sequence of unitary gates. Here, with this state as a resource, you can perform universal quantum computation by local measurements. So what you do is you choose a local basis of measurement at every vertex, and then you measure that particular qubit in the respective basis, and that realizes universal quantum computing too. So in a sense, the cluster state is a universal substrate for quantum computing. I mean, you need to create entanglement in course of the quantum computation. These measurements, because they are local, they only destroy entanglement. So all entanglement that can ever be in that computation must have been provided in advance. And it is provided by the cluster state. But the cluster state is just a blank sheet of paper, in a way, and you can implement an algorithm by measuring the respective qubits. Now, how do we tell this quantum state what algorithm to implement? Well, this we tell by choosing the measurement basis. Well, the measurement basis is something that we can choose. Yes?
Do you define the cluster state?
Yes, it is. It is the graph state with this particular graph.
I don't think I understood the definition of the graph state.
You did?
You specify a graph, and,
yeah,
and in addition, it specifies something else, or just a graph?
Just a graph. Okay, so where the graph enters is here, right? It defines the edge set. Okay. Yeah?
Is there an easy, quick way of going from your graph to a circuit model?
No.
To generate your graph?
It is not. I mean, if I wanted to explain it, I would need to spend a lecture today. It's not so simple. Well, maybe it wouldn't take the entire lecture, but there are lots of things to talk about, and this is not sort of the purpose of today's lecture, but I can give you the reference if you want to read about it. Oh, it's probably too small. Fifth ref letters. Mm. 86. Page. Blah, blah, blah. So, whatever you want to know about it, you can read it here if you want to. Anyway, so where was I? Okay, so we tell the quantum state which algorithm it shall implement by the choice of the measurement base. Yes?
Sorry. Can you do a pure measurement, or do you need a feed forward to it at all?
Feed forward, you mean classical communication?
Yeah,
yes, you do need classical communication, because, well, measurement outcomes are random, those we cannot control, and we must adapt bases for measurements according to measurement outcomes that we have obtained elsewhere. So classical communication is required, and this also gives you a temporal ordering of the measurements. So you cannot perform them all simultaneously. There is a temporal complexity associated with this. It is flatter, though, than the circuit complexity. Okay, really, I don't want to go too deeply into this. Okay, so this gives us one representative that makes that is fun to discuss. And well, I'll tell you a little more about graph space, but now let's talk about the other thing here, about surface codes. So there is another way to associate stabilizer states or stabilizer codes with graphs. But these times, the graph is planar. So let me, oh well. I hope this is not going to be confusing. All right, so let's call this lattice graph G tilde. And so this way of associating a graph with a quantum state or a code space is different, right? Graph looks like what we have here, but there's a different identification. So this time, the qubits sit on the edges, not on the vertices. And because it is a planar graph, it is a graph specified by a set of vertices, edges, and faces. Okay, I already said edges are associated with qubits.
What do you mean by faces?
Well, two chains. Mathematically speaking, things like that.
But aren't the faces actually defined from your vertices and your edges set?
Well, yes, they are in a sense. But I mean, it is sort of a particular feature of a planar graph to have faces, to support faces. Not every, not every graph has this property of having faces. Well, let me try to give you an example. Yes, you can draw it in the plane without crossings.
So the
excuse me, say it again.
Yes,
it is implicitly defined. So when I'm using this notation, I am sort of making the statement that I have faces in this graph, which is not the case for a general graph. So that has that therefore, this identification is only for planar graphs. Okay, so the edges are associated with the qubits, and the faces and the sides will be associated with stabilizer generators. So let's start with the faces. Faces are associated with stabilizer generators. And the same for the vertices. Okay, but they are of different type. So how do the stabilizer generators look like they are associated with the faces? Well, so I have one for every face. Let's consider this face. Well, it's a fourfold tensor product of Pauli operators sitting on the edges of that face. Yeah. And we call this guy S face. And we have stabilizer generators associated with the sides too. So let's choose this side, for example. And they are fourfold tensor products of Pauli spin flip operator sigma x on edges that end in that side. Okay, so we call this guy side operator of the side S.
It's not necessarily fourfold, right?
Ooh, no, it is not necessarily fourfold. And that's correct because we do not need to have a lattice graph. We just require a planar graph. So that planar graph could be anything. It could be, I don't know, whatever you like. But also in such a graph, so the site operators, anyway, so exactly, it wouldn't be fourfold. It doesn't have to be fourfold. But you can check in any case that these operators mutually commute. But that's what they have to.
So
all the z operators mutually commute. It's sort of trivial. Same for the x guys. Now, what about the commutation of the z-type stabilizer operator with the x-type operators? Well, so what if they have no support? It's trivial if they are overlapping. Consider what happens. So they are always overlapping in an even number of places. And then if you pass them by another, you pick an pick up an even number of minus one. That's what it's needed. Okay.
For the graph space, so a graph defined single is not just a space, just one single space.
It's a, yeah, and yeah, and I'm coming to the dimension over here in a minute of the code space. Here, it is just a state, and the reason for this is that you have as many generators of the stabilizer as you have qubits. So if you have, well, what's the in the stabilizer formalism, what's the dimension of the stabilized Hilbert space? The dimension of the stabilized Hilbert space for qubits is 2 to the number of qubits, minus the number of the stabilizer generators. Yeah. Okay, so in that case over there, these two numbers are the same. So the dimension of the stabilized filter space is 1. That's not going to be like this in the example over here. Okay? Okay, so
for the graph state, all those generators are independent?
Yes, they are independent.
Okay.
And, oh, no, they are associated with the vertices. So you have, look, here you have such a generator. So you, and you have one such generator for each vertex.
Yeah.
Oh, and you can easily see why they are independent. So, well, because...
Well, the index, it's a category to all the beads that have this condition.
The condition is for the z's.
For the tensor product.
Yeah. Yeah, for the tensor product. Okay, you see why they're all independent? Okay, but then let me quickly show you. I mean, it's really simple. So we'll single out a site A, say site 1 here. So that stabilizer generator has a sigma exiting here and z's on the neighbors. So the question is, if it is dependent, I must find product of other generators as I have written them down here, such that I can express this guy as the product of the others. But all the others, I mean, they are centered around other qubits. So they have either a sigma z here or the identity here. So I could never write this stabilizer generator that I've chosen centered at that site as a product of the other ones. And therefore they are all independent. All right, so let me first discuss the dimension of the stabilized space over here, and then give you sort of the most relevant example. Oh no, let me give you the most relevant example first. So, and the relevant example for the surface code is the so-called toric code. And the surface on which that code lives is a torus. So it's periodic boundary conditions. And an interesting fact, I mean, we could now ask, how many qubits can we store on such a torus? And maybe naively you would expect, the larger the surface, the more you can store. But that actually is not the case. The number of qubits you can store here is a function of the surface topology, not of the surface size. So the result is, so maybe I should give you the answer first, and we want to see it in a minute. The number of qubits that you could store here in that code surface is 2. And in general, the number of qubits that you could store. Number of qubits you could store. Store is 2 times the genus of the surface. G is the genus of the surface. Okay, so you remember the definition of the genus of the surface?
No.
Okay. Well, it's sort of the number of handles that a surface has. So imagine some closed surface and put some handles into it. And the genus is just the number of these handles. So for the surface, excuse me, for the torus, the genus is 1. For, that's intended to denote a sphere, right? For the sphere, the genus is 0, meaning that the code associated just with the sphere could not store a qubit. Again, just be a state. Okay. And this is, okay, well, yeah. So let me sort of finish the introduction with proving this fact. Maybe I go to the other board. Let me just write it again. So the question here is, what's the dimension of the Hilbert space stabilized by our stabilizer generators? So we have a code space. That's the code space. And the question that we are asking is, okay, but before I go into these technicalities, so to speak, maybe I sort of should finish off this introduction over here. So why care? These toric codes, the toric code, the other surface code, they have some very nice properties. What's so nice about them? So for example, the stabilizer of the code is translation invariant. So that's the whole associated with that is you can create code words of the toric code in a translation invariant manner. And that is, of course, very suitable for physical systems because many physical systems, or in particular lattice systems, are translation invariant. So that's something nice. Also, you have low weight stabilizer generators. Did Daniel mention the role of the weight of a stabilizer generator already? Did you discuss issues related to the weight of stabilizer generators? Yeah? I mean, if they have a large weight, the idea of error correction is to measure these operators. And if you measure a large weight stabilizer operator requires a lot of quantum operations, and all these are noisy, and that reduces your threshold tremendously. So for fault tolerant quantum computation with a high threshold, this is what you want: low weight stabilizer generators. Okay.
Isn't noise that a laser generator might give you a small distance code?
No.
Not necessarily?
No. And in fact, this is what we are going to discuss in a couple of minutes. Have I really been talking? Well, when did I start?
Quarter past.
Okay. Yeah, but we're definitely going to discuss this. No, the distance of this code will be large. Namely, the distance of that code is equal to the shortest cycle on that surface. So you make the code surface large, doesn't allow you to encode more qubits, but you make the distance large. Okay, good. Doesn't lead to short distance of the code. Okay, so this is the motivation. I mean, this is a code which has very nice properties, especially from a physics point of view. And although I'm not going to talk about it today, these two guys can be combined. Cluster states and surface code states by allowing ourselves to go one dimension higher up. So if I consider a cluster state in three dimensions, well, we have two here. If we go to three spatial dimensions, well, we inherit, so to speak, the universality from this side and the fault tolerance from this side. So we can do fault tolerant quantum computation by local measurements, which I think probably be a topic for this course here, but maybe not at that stage, right? Sort of this finishes my motivation, and now I am going to tell you some facts. So where were we? We wanted to compute the dimension of the code space for the surface code. So what we need to do is we need to count the number of qubits and the number of stabilizer generators. So number of qubits, so for this purpose, let me write down the dimension of the Hilbert space. So that's the formula we already had. The number of qubits minus the number of stabilizer generators. Okay, so now just from the definition of the state, the number of qubits is, because there's one qubit on every edge, it's just the number of edges, size of P. And okay, now let's count the stabilizer generators. So, well, there is following. Are you following me? Yeah? Anybody else? You are still with the cluster state, I believe.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, the number of stabilizer generators. So it is. So we have one such generator associated with every face and one with every side. So the total number of stabilizer generators is the number of faces plus the number of sides in the lattice. Any objections? No? Okay, but it's not correct. And why is that? Well, it is true that we do have a stabilizer element associated with every face, but they are not independent, and so they cannot be all generators. And why is this? Well, if we multiply them all together, you see, if we multiply them all together, we get the identity operation. And so this is a constraint. And well, in fact, this is the only constraint we have. So for the faces, we get a minus one here. And for the sides, it's exactly the same thing. We get a minus one here. Okay. Now, we can put it all together and find that the dimension of our Hilbert space is thus 2 to the number of edges minus the number of sides minus the number of faces plus 2. Okay. And now, this linear combination has a certain name. And it's called the Euler characteristic. Okay. Precisely, it is minus the Euler characteristic of a surface. And, well, if we have a surface, we can sort of slice it up in arbitrary number of faces with their edges and vertices and so on and so forth. But whatever we do, this linear combination of number of edges, number of sides, number of faces is independent of the way we slice it up. It is an invariant that only depends on the surface. Okay? And in fact, the Euler characteristic of a surface is, I have to look that up. Now my notes. The Euler characteristic is 2 minus 2g. So remember, g was the genus of the surface. And, okay. You don't?
No, I said I remember
too bad.
That one where it comes from.
Too bad. Okay, anyway. So we plug this in here. And we obtain 2 to the 2g as a dimension of the Hilbert space, meaning we can encode 2 qubits. Okay, that's just what we wanted to show. All right. So, now. I'd like to give you an outline of what I plan to discuss. So,
you can start 4 qubits on that?
2. So, what would be the dimension of the Hilbert space spanned by 4 qubits? 16, yeah. 16. 2 to the 4.
The dimension.
Okay. It's the dimension, yes. Okay, so one in my list was this dimension thing. 2 here, error correction with surface codes. Number 3 is creation. And I suppose I start here on the side of the ground states. Number 4 on my list is ground states. Set of graph states is the set of equivalent states modulo local clip of unitaries. So what this means is, if you don't care about local operations, and that's usually what we do in quantum information, we say local operation on quantum systems and classical communication is for free. So what this says is graph states, so to speak, map the entire set of stabilizer states. More precisely, when I start with a stabilizer state, I can apply local unitaries such that I end up with a graph state. So all the entanglement properties that I find in stabilizer states are in graph states. But number 5, so in particular, I can't, well, so I will show this by giving an explicit mapping from stabilizer states to the corresponding graph states. So I can think of graph states as a normal form. But normal form is not unique. Non-uniqueness. Normal form Okay, number six. Okay, number six, I'll tell you when I come to that. So that would be about the plan for what I want to tell you. I do not expect to get through with that. But anyway, I just thought and then I see how far I get. So what's next? Error correction with the surface code. Let me draw a section of the code, part of the code surface again. So to remind you, on the sides we have the X-type stabilizer, and on the plaquettes we have the Z-type stabilizer. Okay, to simplify the discussion, let's assume for the moment that we have only X and Z errors. Of course, I mean, we have Y errors as well, but they sort of complicated discussion. So, oh no, let's start otherwise. So we have X, Y, and Z errors. Where do the Z errors show up? Well, they show up in the X part of the syndrome. Where do the X errors show up? Well, they show up in the Z part of the syndrome. Where do the Y errors show up? Well, in both syndromes. But so in a way, we can think of X and Z errors occurring separately, and Y errors are just combinations of them. So they can introduce a different feature here. Okay, and now because the X error and the Z errors are detected by different parts of the syndrome, we may discuss them separately. And also, you see that there is, you could go, well, there is sort of an equivalence between the Z-type error correction and the X-type error correction. So you see that these operators look the same. They have this sort of the same size of support. Well, and therefore the error correction is analogous. So for what I'm going to discuss, I will only discuss Z errors, and the discussion of X errors would be completely analogous. Right? So let me discuss the Z errors. That will be the location of our qubits. And now suppose a Z error would occur somewhere. Exactly. Okay, how would I learn about it? I would learn about it by measuring the syndrome. In this case, by measuring the X part of the syndrome. Is there a question? No question, okay. Yeah, so if in particular this error occurs, where do I detect a non-trivial syndrome? Well, I detect a non-trivial syndrome at the stabilizer location, or at the stabilizers that anti-commute with this Pauli operator, which is this one or this one, and this one. Okay. So geometrically, I may associate my errors with the edges of the lattice, as I have done before with the qubits. And each error, so I write a Z-type error as a function of a one chain. We call this a one chain. In this example, it's just an edge. Okay? And, well, more general chains are now combinations of edges. So, for example, this longer chain would be a tensor product of these three errors. And, I could ask myself, But what does the syndrome look like? So what syndrome does this error chain lead to? Well, and well, each error chain, so again, we have a geometrical picture here. So an error chain leads to a non-trivial syndrome at its boundary. So the syndrome occurs at the boundary. So in the case of this chain here, the syndrome locations would be here and here. But no syndrome would be visible here and here at the intermediate locations. And you can directly verify it in terms of the stabilizer formalism. So I have shown you the error, and sort of the stabilizer operator located here would be an x, x, x over here, x here. And you see it commutes with the error chain. So a syndrome is revealed only at the endpoints of the chain. So, well, we see that this is a very degenerate code because we have a huge number of error chains which have the same endpoints. And the syndrome does not allow us to discriminate between them. But it doesn't matter. So consider two error chains. P of C1 prime such that the boundary of C1 equals the boundary of C1 prime. Okay, then obviously the syndrome associated with the two chains is the same. But the question is, does it matter? And for most cases, it doesn't. So, given this condition here, we can have two cases. Case A C1 plus C2 or 2B C1 plus C prime is itself the boundary of some two-dimensional object, right? Well, this is a subcase of what we have up here, because if I apply the boundary operator to that equation, what I get is boundary of C1 plus boundary of C1 prime is boundary of C2, and you may remember that double application of the boundary operator annihilates every chain. Okay, so we clearly see that case A is a subcase of what we have up here. But then there's another case.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What does the boundary operator do?
What it does, it maps a chain to its boundary. So for example, so we have a one chain here. It takes that chain and maps it to its boundary. Oh my God. So I haven't really introduced the notion of chain complexes and so on and so forth. So what you have here is, that's a chain complex consisting of a bunch of vector spaces I don't want to do this. I don't want to get so mathematical here. let me explain in physical terms what happens. So if let me explain in physical terms what happens. Or say in a pictorial way. Let me give you an example of the situation here. So this would be the chain C1, and this would be the chain C1. So both have the same boundary. I mean, the boundary is just, it's the set, so to speak, of its endpoints. Okay. And what we see here in this example is when I open. And so I should say that sort of what we do, we can add these chains. And what addition means is addition modulo 2. So for example, when I have this chain and want to add this chain, because of this addition modulo 2, what I get is just this piece here. Okay, but now adding this chain plus this chain just gives me this cycle. And this cycle is the boundary of that phase, right? So now I need to explain sort of the boundary operator one dimension higher up. And the boundary of a phase is a bunch of phases. Okay, and this is the harmless case here. Because physically the two operations, the error associated with chain one and the error associated with the chain C1 prime, they are not the same physical operations. But they act in the same way on the code space. And how do I see this? Well, this guy is this guy times a stabilizer operator. Okay, we can sort of go through the labor and verifying this directly. So this error is sort of the Z error on that edge, and this is threefold sigma Z, nothing here, times fourfold sigma Z, right? You just multiply it out. Sigma Z squared is the identity. You get that thing over here. Okay. So that's the nice case. If the two error chains differ by the boundary of a phase or the set of phases, that's nice. But then there is a nasty case where this is not the case. And that causes a logical error. And let me give you an example of a nasty situation. So consider this as the error C1. And no error at all. Now I'm assuming periodic boundary conditions. So that thing goes, is a closed loop. So that is C1, and C1 prime is just the identity. Okay? So, both have the same syndrome, namely none. Right? This chain doesn't have a boundary because it's a closed loop. And, they do not differ by the boundary of a face or by the boundary of a surface. And that's a nasty case. So in this case, the two associated errors are not equivalent. And sort of having this error present in interpreting it for this error, namely no error, will introduce a logical error. But this is a rare event. So this error chain now is very long. And if you assume that you have a local error model And you will hopefully have local error models and implementation of quantum computers to some extent local errors. But let me make it simple. So with every edge, with every element, with every light element or every qubit, you have an error probability p associated. Well, so with every edge that you add, you pick up a factor of p, and the probability of this this error, capital p here, is sort of our base probability p to the length of the cycle. And well, this will be a small number, and you can make it arbitrarily small by making the torus big, making the surface big. Okay? So, and this is where the error correction capability of the surface code comes from. Okay, in particular, to go back to the question that I was asked, sort of low weight stabilizer does not imply small distance. So we can, well, we have weight 4 in the stabilizer general. Yes?
So if you have a errors of all the 4 edges around the face,
yes,
how does that show up? Does it show up at all?
Yeah, I mean, physically it could happen.
Yeah, but does it show up in the syndrome?
No, it doesn't show up in the syndrome.
No, so 4 errors that you lost, no matter how big you are?
No, because, I mean, it's sort of an error operator, but it acts in the same way on the code space as the identity.
Okay.
Right? So 4 errors is in the stabilizer, okay. So it acts the same way on the code space as the identity. So it can happen, but it doesn't hurt you.
So it's a decoherent free subspace.
Yeah, if you wish. So what hurts you are these cycles, but they must be macroscopically big.
Is there a way to calculate the length of the cycle, the maximal cycle given the genus and the number of qubits?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. You would have to look at it in some detail. But I mean, I would suggest I think there shouldn't be too much of a trade-off. I think you can. I don't want to talk about it. I would need to look at it. Okay, so that was error correction with the surface codes, and that was item number 2 on my list, and I think the lecture is over, right? It's 6:15.
No, it's not yet at 6:30. You're not past
6:30. Oh, okay, so I have some time left.
Can I have a quick question?
Yes.
Okay, so basically what you're doing is you've got all these qubits. The stabilizers are the vertices.
Yeah.
You're measuring them all at the same time to figure out what your syndrome you get.
Yes.
So it's the stabilizers are all 4, or at least in this graph, they're all sort of 4-fold plus identities everywhere else.
Yes.
You're measuring them all at the same time to figure out your
syndrome
and then going ahead and doing your regression after that.
Yes.
The physical picture?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the model a lot of details. Because I mean, you would not need to do the error correction physically. You just need to sort of account for it, and you need to remember where errors have occurred, but you never need to physically correct. Well, you will come across that point later in your lecture. Okay. So the next step, or next point I want to talk about in this lecture is creation of these things. And let me talk about graph states first. So graph states, it's very simple. It's a two-step procedure. Step one, prepare a product state. Everybody familiar with this notation? Plus means sigma x eigenstate, eigenvalue 1. So, Okay. Step number two. By following unitary, it's a product of conditional phase gates. Yeah, so this guy just means conditional phase gate between the qubits A and B, where this runs over all edges of the graph. So that's what you do. Okay, so in particular, note that all these gates commute. I mean, if you draw them as gates, you might want to apply them in sequence, but there is no physical reason to do so. So they are commuting gates, and in principle, you could apply them simultaneously. So there is no need for a temporal complexity associated with creating these gates.
Sorry, what's the half?
The half is a lambda. And, well, this is the conditional phase gate. So lambda Z between two qubits A and B is E to the I pi 1, 1, A, B. Oh, the red one's different. Pi 1. Like this. Conditional phase gate. Okay, so let us quickly verify this. And the way we verify this is in the stabilizer formalism. So what we do is we check how. Okay, so this guy corresponds to a stabilizer XA and A and B. And we check how the stabilizer evolves when we apply these gates. How does it evolve? Well, so this guy goes into U X A, and now I really don't know where the dagger comes. I mean, we could check it out, but I mean, you have heard this in the last lecture that you follow you follow the stabilizer by conjugating under the unitary evolution. So the dagger is on either side, either here or here. I don't remember right now. I mean, you should be able to check or look in your notes. But in our case, it doesn't matter anyway, because the conditional phase gate is its own conjugate. So in this particular case, this is true. In the general case, I have a dagger on either of the two sides. Okay, so we need to verify what this gives us. And now, well, let's consider a portion of the graph. We have a vertex qubit here, starting out with a stabilizer generator like this. And now we have conditional phase gates associated with all these edges. Okay, so there are other qubits over here. And I don't know if you have, well, Ray had such an example on the board today, but just with the CNOT gate. So I suppose you have checked how these conjugation relations look like. So what every conditional phase gate does, it me write it down, and I'm going to set on an edge AB conjugating XA gives XA tensor ZB. So every conditional phase gate that I apply brings out a Z. Okay, and this is what I need for the stabilizer of the cluster state. First, in more general terms, the graph state. Okay, so I would like to emphasize the point that these guys here, they are all commuting, so there is no temporal order, or basically no temporal complexity associated with the creation of this state. We will see that, because now I'm turning to the surface code state, and I will give you two ways of creating it. We will see that things look a little different here. If we try to create, or maybe different is not the right word. But anyway, what I want to stress here with the surface code state is that if you want to create the surface code state with short range entangling gates, then the time increases size. If you want to do it unitarily. So the first, and then maybe I'm only sketching it and you can verify it at home. The first way, so this is creation of the surface code state. Not surface code state. Okay, so the first way that I show you how to do it will be unitary, and the temporal complexity increases with time, excuse me, with the size. And the second method I show you will not increase with the size. The temporal complexity won't increase with size, but it is non-unitary, involves measurements. Okay, so here's the. You can verify it at home. I will not do it for you right now. So suppose, so this is again the lattice. So we have the qubits sitting here. And suppose this is a surface code state that already has been created. And now we attach another column to it. So what we do is this. Okay, you would bring qubits here in the state zero. Qubits now in state sigma x. Okay, and by the way, every arrow here is a CNOT gate. With where the tip pointing towards the target. Okay, you can verify this at home if you want, that this increases the code surface of the surface code state. Okay, but now you see if you want to attach the other layer, the second layer, you see that a qubit here now is acted upon by a CNOT as a target, where previously it was acted upon by a CNOT as the control. And these two CNOTs do not commute. You need to respect the temporal order, and therefore it is step by step. Well, so this is just one method of creating the cluster state. But you can actually prove that if you want to do it unitarily, temporal complexity increases with the size. Okay, but now I want to present to you another method that is not unitary, that involves measurement. And this is in constant time. And the reason, well, there are two reasons why I want to present this to you. Because first, it is shorter. Second, it makes a connection to cluster states. That was number one. Now comes number two. And it's probably the last thing that I do in this lecture. So let us start with the cluster state. So what I'm going to do, remember, here, the qubits are associated with the vertices. So what I'm going to do now is to measure every second qubit in that state, like this. So first row, every second qubit in the z basis. Second row, every second qubit in the x basis. Third row, every second qubit in the z basis, so on and so forth. Okay. And what I would like to show now is that on the remaining unmeasured qubits, you end up with a state in the code space of the surface code. And of course, these local measurements all commute, so you can do them at the same time. So it's a one-step procedure. OK, so let me show you that we indeed have the stabilizer of the surface code state of these measurements. And to facilitate that, let me show you the surface code lattice that we end up off of the measurements. So how does it look like? You see x, okay. It would be really nice to have another color here. So I'm using these squiggly lines now for the lattice of the surface code. Okay, so this is now a site of the lattice for the surface code, and this is a plaquette. Okay, so let's verify that surface code stepwise. So for the cluster state, we start with the stabilizer. For example, I'm drawing one stabilizer generator now, which is x tensor z. I would really help to have another column.
I think there are colors there, right?
Yeah.
There. No.
What? Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Here's the green one. Okay, thanks. Okay. So let's stabilize. I'm drawing one stabilizer now of the state before the measurement. Right? You remember this was a cluster state stabilizer. Now, you see that this qubit has been measured in the x basis. And now, this stabilizer, xA, tensor zB, with that usual condition, this goes after the x measurement here. It goes into plus minus, depending on the eigenvalue that I measure. Well, then the unmeasured part just remains. So we don't worry about the sign factor this time. You could take out that stuff. But you see that what's remaining is the plaquette operator. Okay? And you can show the same thing for the site operators as well. I'm not going to do it unless you want me to. You also can do it as an exercise if you like. So, and why did I end my lecture with this thing here? I mean, of course, because I just ran out of time at that point. But maybe it's not so bad to stop with this figure here, because you see that there is a connection between surface code states and cluster states in two dimensions. And when I finish my introduction, I said we can combine the surface codes with the cluster states in three dimensions to get universal fault tolerant quantum computation. So in two dimensions, we get the fault tolerance of surface code states. But we also want to do some processing, and that requires a third dimension. So maybe on that note, I stop.
You said before that you don't need to physically correct errors.
Yes.
So you can just, but this means that, if that's true, it means that you don't, it doesn't matter if your state goes out of the code.
Yeah, but you can afford that. And let me illustrate that.
Because it's true that you need to even elastic system, and so you don't even need to keep track of anything.
Okay, so no. Don't get me wrong. Let me just give me a... So the point is, I mean, if an error occurs and you don't correct for it, you just interpret the syndrome and make a guess what you think it was, then you sort of end up in a different subspace. But that different subspace is equally good as long as you remember which subspace you are in. Okay, explain it. Let me explain it a bit.
Don't even use a subsystem. Not subspace.
Okay, so I mean subspace. So, say your total Hilbert space is a direct sum.
Can you just do that to the p-qubit computation code and then we see what if one bit error happens in the first one,
mm-hmm.
you see, there was a bit error in the first one. Mm-hmm. So now my code block is instead of 0000111, it's 100011. Let me say, and then I have a classical computer where I remember what's my current subspace.
And yeah, I understand, but if you can do that, you have an elastic system and you don't actually really need to remember it because.
You do. Okay, so maybe we are just talking about different ways to take care of the syndrome information. But let's go to that thing with the direct sum, small Hilbert space later, but maybe it's more better illustration if I start like this. So suppose, I mean, you have some circuit and it's just a dummy example. And at some point, there occurs an error. Say a Z error. And then, I mean, lots of other qubits, and then suppose you do your error correction. And you measure the syndrome, and that allows you to make a guess on what the error was. And maybe you correctly identify this error here. But you do not correct for it. So what happens? So suppose this goes on like this, and then say you have Qx rotations. By this I mean something like for some alpha. Okay, so what happens is this. Okay, now when the error occurs, it is unknown. After the error correction, it is known but you know that you have a zero here, but you decide not to correct for it. So what else do you need to do? Well, having a z, that you have seen, if that's not what I'm talking about now, is error propagation. Having a z error here is the same thing as having a z error here and here.
Okay, you don't mean that you can let zero error.
But
you don't mean that you can let zero error happen. Is it correct? Sure, you can just, if you have one error which happens, mm-hmm. then you can wait until the end and then you correct.
Oh, well, I mean, suppose that it was a different code block, if that's what you're alluding to.
No, that's not it. I'm just saying that you can.
Your file is almost the number of errors less than your disk.
Okay, but that's not what I want to get into. So the disk is question. Suppose that for a different code block. Oh my god, it's just an example.
Well, if you know that there happens is an error there, right? You measure it and you know it. And then you can do the propagation. And then you set some data point. Ah, there's another one because it's some other point you also measure. And okay, now it's happened another z error. They might actually cancel at the end, but that's fine.
But you can take more half. Well, you have a finite dispatch, so you can take more errors happen.
No, that's actually not the case. I mean, this at this point, after I've done the error, sort of the syndrome measurement here, mm-hmm. this is sort of a known error, in a way. Yes. So this is an unknown error, and this is a known error. That is, I mean, there is, I haven't corrected for it, so there is an error there, but I know it. And a known error is as good as no error. Which doesn't mean that I don't need to take it into account. And this is what I wanted to explain. I mean, I can propagate it forward. And sort of the non-trivial thing happens here. So what if this guy passes through the rotations, it reverses the angle. And that is now a different rotation. So if I know that I have errors in my computation that the syndrome detected, but I didn't correct, instead I need to adapt my subsequent computation by adjusting rotation angles, but that's all. And what's the point of this whole thing? It saves me operations, right? The operations that correct the error here are themselves erroneous, and by sort of not performing error correction, but just taking into account the error, I can save a few error locations.
And if a similar error happens, can you handle it?
If, again?
You detect a second error. Can you handle that?
Yes.
Is it correct in the first?
Yes. So, sort of, from the viewpoint of the capabilities of error correction, as I said, a detected error is as good as no error. It doesn't sort of show up in the bill anymore. After you have detected an error, you still have the sort of the full distance of the code.